So, football is coming home. Or is it? Might it be going to Rome? Dominic Sambrook with me. A night of titanic passion and drama last night as the England football team, following in the footsteps of their Anglo-Saxon forebears who won at the battles of Edington, of Tettenhall, of Brunanburh, smashed the Danish shield wall.
Yes, it wasn't quite the smashing the shield wall that you might have hoped for, was it?
No, I'm grotesquely exaggerating.
It was tense, and the Danes were, I mean, they could claim they were a little bit unlucky, but it was, apart from the shining of laser pens and so on, which...
the laser pen of God.
Yeah, which I think the Anglo-Saxons might have frowned upon. I thought, you know, the Danes bowed out very gallantly. As I thought, as I hoped they would.
We love the Danes.
So the Danes are kind of our kin, aren't they? They're our northern brethren. So this time is the final is going to be very different, because the Italians are their people against whom we've defined ourselves, but in completely different ways. They're our cultural opposites in various ways. I mean, we do have a really fascinating intertwined history, but they are the kind of stereotype, aren't they? The Mediterranean non-Britons, if you like.
But looking at it in the broadest possible span, I mean, I think you can make the case for saying that of all Europe's countries, perhaps none of them has had a profounder influence
than
on
Italy.
Our history than Italy.
I think we've said that about every country,
no,
with
I
the possible
think, I
exception
think we have.
Of Ukraine.
I think we said that the rivalry between England and Denmark was the oldest, which I think is true. But I think that the influence that Italy has had in various manifestations and in various ways, it's kind of beyond profound. And the idea that we can sum it all up in 40, 50 minutes is ludicrous. But we should probably crack on, shouldn't we?
Yeah. If you're going to go back beyond the creation of Italy as a country, then of course that's true. Especially if you go back to one of your specialisms, which is where I imagine you're going to kick off.
Well, it is, because I thought we really need to define Italy and England. So, Italy actually is much older than the founding of the Italian kingdom in the 19th century, because absolutely the Romans had a sense of Italy as a coherent identity, certainly by the early second century BC, possibly before that. And actually the beginning of the first century BC, when the various Italian peoples and cities rebel against Rome, they mint coins with the name Italia on it, and they proclaim a kind of a unitary Italy in opposition to Roman rule. So, you know, that's the kind of precursor for what happens in the 19th century that I think makes it legitimate to talk about Italy.
Even though Italy then kind of went underground for so many centuries between those two points.
Yes, but the Romans have a sense of themselves as Italian.
Okay.
Certainly. And so I think it's telling that the first description of what will in due course become England is from Italian. It's from Julius Caesar, who leads expeditions against Britain in 55 BC, 54 BC, writes it up in massive self-promoting commentaries, self-aggrandizing, the kind of thing that you would never do, Dominic. And
thank you, Tom.
And obviously the Romans then invade permanently in 43 AD, and Britain becomes part of the Roman Empire for kind of four centuries. The Romans then withdraw, and the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, according to later tradition, then invade and seize what had been the Roman province of Britannia, and this in due course becomes England. So when we're talking about England against Italy, really I think we need to start looking at the Anglo-Saxons rather than say with Caratacus or Boudicca. Or
so you're not including, if this was Wales v Italy, which did happen earlier in the tournament, you would have gone in with Boudicca and Caratacus and so on. But you're disbarring them for the purposes of this podcast.
I think so. There are arguments. There are scholars who argue that a form of Proto-English was spoken in the eastern half of Britain.
Really?
And there's an argument that Boudicca is actually a pun. So in Celtic languages, it means victory, victoria. So that's why you get the statue of Boudicca outside Houses of Parliament. Suppose there was a kind of proto-English, a kind of Germanic language. It's possible that, say, Wicca, as in, you know, Wicca now, the religion, means a woman. And it's possible that there's an illusion there that it means a woman who's been attacked or a woman who's been raped, which, of course, Boudicca was, and precipitates the rebellion. So perhaps there are kind of pockets of proto-English being spoken, but it's a highly controversial opinion, not widely accepted, and not one that I think we should be going into now. Right. This is way too complicated.
I can see the rabbit hole beckoning.
But what I would say is that for the Anglo-Saxons, Rome is kind of central to their imagination. It's kind of almost the capital of their imaginings. And they have a very, very kind of profound emotional, spiritual relationship to the idea of Rome.
Yes.
That I think is, you know, basically provides the kind of seedbed from which English attitudes to Italy generally come from.
So English kings, the very first English kings, or the kings of the people we recognise as the English, did they see themselves, do you think, as the heirs to the Roman emperors? Minting coins and living maybe in the last kingdom of Bernard Cornwell series, their palaces are kind of in the ruins of Roman villas and things. Is that, do you think, how they saw themselves?
I think they have a sense of themselves as peripheral to Rome.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they still see themselves kind of a colonial relationship to the metropolis. Because if you look at the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is this kind of year-by-year account of history, it begins with Julius Caesar coming to Britain. And so in a sense, the Anglo-Saxons are identifying the beginnings of their history with Rome's first contact with the island in which they will come to live.
Yeah.
So that's kind of defining themselves through Rome. And again, if you look at Bede, who is the first great historian of England, so much of our information about Anglo-Saxon England and its beginnings comes from Bede. And his kind of opening, he describes Britain, which was once called Albion, he says, is an island in the ocean and it lies to the northwest. And what's fascinating about that is that Bede is situating Britain relative to Rome.
Right.
So he's taking on a Roman perspective.
Yes.
So in that sense, there's still a kind of a hint of the colonized to it.
Yeah, Rome is the center of the world.
Rome is the center
and Britain
of the world.
Is at the edge. Okay, I buy that. I completely buy that. I mean, presumably all European peoples, except the sort of Scandinavians, certainly all Western European peoples, but in the, well, people used to call the Dark Ages, define themselves that way, right? Rome used to be the center and it still is.
But there's a sense also, I think, I mean, you asked about kings. So even before England gets converted to the Roman form of Christianity, there's a group of kings in East Anglia, probably the guys who bury the ship at Sutton Hoo, called the Wolfingas.
Right.
And scholars have argued that the name wolf that's embedded in that may well part of put it on their coins that make great riffs about the wolf. Of course, the wolf suckles Romulus and Remus.
Yes.
So perhaps that's a part of it. Certainly in their genealogy, they like all the Anglo-Saxon kings, they trace it back to Woden, the king of the gods. But they distinctively say that the son of Woden was Caesar, and therefore they are descended from Caesar. And this is a tradition. This you asked, do the Anglo-Saxon kings kind of ape the model of imperial rule? They absolutely do. Yeah. So the story is told of Alfred. He definitely goes to Rome on pilgrimage once, but he's supposed also to have gone as a boy and to have been blessed by the Pope and to have been anointed by him, rather as Charlemagne did. I mean, this is most unlikely to have happened because there was no prospect at that point that Alfred was going to become king. But it's a story that matters and it gets told. In due course, Athelstan, Alfred's grandson, he is the first king of the whole of England, and he summons kings from across the north of Britain, so those stretches of Britain that the Romans had never conquered, kings of the Scots, kings from the Strathclyde, and he summons them to a place called Aemont in Cumbria. And what's significant about that place is that there's a Roman fortress there, so there's a symbol of Roman power. And Athelstan then, he holds these kind of great durbars in Roman cities, presumably in the kind of amphitheatres that are still functional and which established the prototype for Wembley.
So, very good.
You know, it's where it all begins.
Yeah.
And Edgar, who we mentioned in the podcast about against Denmark, he has this very imperial coronation. And where does he choose to have it? In Bath, which is
because full of Roman buildings.
The most extravagantly, the most extravagantly imperial city in Britain. So I think that is absolutely a part of it. That there's a kind of a cultural cringe before the idea of the Roman Empire and a desire to emulate it.
So this is then, a very good start for Italy in this podcast.
It's looking good. So that's good. So we're, yes, so the kind of intimidating presence of the Italian team, we're flinching before it. But
yeah,
there's also stuff that we can learn because, of course, Rome is not significant only as an imperial capital, as was, but as the city of the popes.
Yes. I thought we'd get to the popes.
The place where Peter and Paul are martyred, where the Bishop of Rome has his bishopric. And it's the Bishop of Rome who sends missionaries to convert the pagan Anglo-Saxons. And the guy who does that is Gregory the Great, who is a massive punster.
A punster?
He's a punster. He loves his puns.
Right.
So it's a famous story that he goes out into the slave market in Rome and he sees these blonde children, who've come from a kingdom called Deira, part of Northumbria in northern England. And he asks who they are, and he's told that they are Angli. And he says, non Angli, sed Angeli, not Angles, but angels. And everyone collapses into laughter. And when he asks where they come from, he's told Deira. He says, Deira, which means from anger. I have been called to rescue them from the anger of Satan.
Oh, my word.
Wow. So, I mean, stream of terrible jokes.
Yes. So this is like some sort of, Foreign Football Association in the 1990s saying, we'll send you some coaches to break your long ball game and teach you how to play proper football.
Exactly.
We'll send you Claudio Ranieri and Gianluca Vialli and so on.
Exactly. Well, actually, and the English end up, they take Gregory as their celestial patron. So they imagine that at the end of days, Gregory will plead their case before the throne of God.
Right.
But they set up a kind of training school in Rome. So they set up a hostel where pilgrims can stay. It actually preserves a trace in the street plan of Rome to this day because they call it a burr.
Oh, right. After Alfred's burrs.
After Alfred's burrs. And it's the Burgo Santo Spirito, which is the kind of the road that leads from the Tiber up to the piazza in front of St. Peter's.
Yeah,
that preserves, you know, that derives from the burg, which was there because that's where it stood.
Very nice. But obviously the Pope, he goes on to be, you know, public enemy number one for generations of English men and women, doesn't he? I mean, even preceding the Reformation, there was a bad blood between the papacy, certainly, and the English crown, right?
Well, in the Anglo-Saxon period, this sense that the Pope is their kind of godfather, I think is...
The Godfather, very nice.
No one has an issue, you know, in every sense of the word. No one has an issue with that. Gregory the Seventh, the kind of great reforming pope of the 11th century, he sends, as we mentioned in our episode on 1066, he sends a banner to William the Conqueror,
yes,
kind of wishing him good luck.
Yeah,
and the reason that Gregory the Seventh is so revolutionary a pope is that essentially he is the guy who pushes the idea that the pope should be superior to all earthly kings. In a way that it hadn't been before.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is what then generates the sense of tension. So you get it with Henry II after he's held responsible for the murder of Thomas Becket.
Yeah.
That essentially has to be kind of whipped through the streets of Canterbury to pay penance. And then, of course, in the reign of John, which we talked about in our episode of Magna Carta, John basically kind of has a massive bust-up with Innocent III, who is a ferociously powerful and authoritarian pope. And John is broken by it. And ends up offering England as a papal fiefdom. He holds it in trust from the Pope. And I think that probably does kind of establish a slight legacy of tension.
So during all that period, I mean, the Italian, the English, as it were, the whipping boys is too strong, but we're definitely in a sort of, to borrow your phrase from the beginning, there's an element of cultural cringe, right?
I think
so. That the Rome is where it is, the papacy is the sort of, you know, the Pope is God's vicar on earth, and English kings sort of basically, you know, they can try to weasel their way out as John did, or as Henry II, you know, by killing the Archbishop of Canterbury. But basically the Pope is the power broker, he's the dominant figure in that relationship.
Yeah, it's the center. I mean, it's the great place of pilgrimage. Jerusalem is under Muslim rule.
Yeah.
So it's too far. But Rome is, you know, for most of the Middle Ages, apart from when the popes go to Avignon, that's the kind of the great court, and it's an earthly as well as a spiritual power. So absolutely, England has a kind of peripheral relationship to it. And on top of that, of course, Italy is also a cultural and an economic powerhouse, increasingly.
Yeah, I was going to ask
as the Middle Ages.
The cultural relationship. So people like, let's say, Chaucer. I mean, Chaucer must have a sense of Italian culture and all that stuff, does he?
Absolutely. Well, Chaucer, so and it's kind of interwoven with the cultural, with the economic power, because the reason that Chaucer goes to Italy is to negotiate trade deals over wool. He wants to improve trade deals, cutting out middlemen, so that you know, this boosts trade and boosts the amount of money that goes directly into English coffers rather than to middlemen in the lowlands. So Chaucer goes to Genoa. He then goes on to Florence. And of course, in Florence, he may well have met Boccaccio, who is the
author of the Decameron.
So this kind of great series of interlinked tales, which almost, you know, provides a model for the Canterbury Tales. And he may have seen Giotto's paintings. So Chaucer is a very European figure and hugely influenced by kind of, you know, Italian culture is massively significant for him, as it is basically for every cutting edge English writer, artist. Italy is the cultural center.
Yeah.
But there's also that sense, you know, he's going there because Italy is incredibly rich. And again, England is kind of economically subordinate. I mean, not entirely. So you start to get banks in Italy, these banking families.
Yeah.
So Edward I borrows obscene amounts from a banking family in Lucca. And then there's a war between England and France. There's a kind of snarl up. There's a credit crunch. Edward needs money from this banking family. He demands it. They can't pay it because they don't have access to ready cash. So Edward then appropriates all their belongings in England.
It's poor form, isn't it?
It's very poor form. It kind of destroys this bank. But it also cripples England's economy, because from that point on, Edward can't borrow.
Completely self-destructive behaviour.
Yes. And over the course of the 14th century, the English kings keep kind of having to agree ever more humiliating terms and then get driven to default. And basically, England in the 14th century, I mean, it's the Argentina of the European economy. Yeah. It's kind of
apologies to our Argentine listeners there,
but it's a kind of, you know, it has a third world relationship to the IMF.
Yeah,
it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think England is in this episode, it's very much a game of two halves, and the first half, England is kind of losing 6-0.
Right, oh, that's very disappointing. What about the Lombard? Where do the Lombards come in, Tom? Are we in Lombard Street and Lombard Bankers? Is that this stage?
Yeah, so Lombard Street is the kind of the main, I mean, it's called the Wall Street of London, isn't it? It's kind of the great concentration of banks now running from bank tube station. And it's named after goldsmiths from Lombardy. And again, it's Edward I. He gives these goldsmiths from Lombardy a plot of land, and that's what they then give their name to what becomes Lombard Street. So again, you see that, again, a bit like a kind of a third world economy wanting to attract inward investment, or indeed Britain now wanting to attract inward investment. You're kind of, you know, you're in an inferior position to those who are able to hand out the economic patronage. So again, that's a kind of another index. You're not getting Italian cities kind of giving plots of land to English merchants, because they don't need it.
If you're a sort of very bright, successful Italian, I mean, England is not really the place you'd move to, right? I mean, I know Italians do. So John Cabot, the explorer, was originally, I don't know, what was he? Giovanni Caboto or something like that, wasn't he? I probably got that completely wrong, but I think it's something along those lines. But by and large, an ambitious young Italian, if you're from a banking family or, you know, you want to go out and seek your fortune in the world, England is not the obvious destination because it's a bit of a backwater. I mean, your obvious destination is presumably France or Castile or somewhere.
I think that's true. I mean, you know, obviously that you get the Venetian ambassadors whose accounts of...
Yeah, they're always writing really
good accounts, aren't they? Murderous doings in England is you know, an incredibly useful source. But it is a bit like, you know, again, a kind of IMF official writing reports from a war-torn dictatorship or something.
From La Paz or something.
Yes, a bit like that, I think. And then, of course, the relationship becomes massively complicated in the 16th century with the Reformation.
When... Yes, because obviously the popes are all Italian at this stage, right? The pope, yeah. That's right, isn't it? So all the popes that Henry VIII falls out with, they are Italians. And Rome itself, I've always wondered whether that point you made earlier about the map that people have, whether that plays a part in the Reformation imagination. So Rome has always been the center of the world. And when Henry says, you know, this Rome of ours is an empire, and, you know, basically sod the Pope and all his cardinals, we don't care what they think, there's a sense of, you know, we're sick of being the puppet controlled by the puppet master. And there is that almost the element of rebelling against the cringe in that.
Yeah, well, I mean, the very fact that Henry is forced into, kind of throwing the Pope out, abandoning the English Church's loyalty to the papacy, is an index of England's marginal status. Because the reason that the Pope can't grant the divorce to Henry is because the Pope has been captured by Charles V, the Emperor.
Yes.
Catherine of Aragon is his aunt.
Yeah.
So Henry doesn't register in the balance.
He's just not as important, is he?
It's not as important. I mean, not as important.
We've got a Henry VIII podcast to come, and Henry's always, he's always trying to be on at center stage with the King of France and the Emperor, but he's very much clearly the third man in that kind of relationship, which clearly irritates him. I always wonder whether that's why he became so fat, because he's just desperate to kind of push them off stage and make himself look bigger, so more important than he was.
Yeah. But I think, that does then recalibrate, obviously, England's relationship, not just with the Roman Church, but with Italian culture generally. Italy remains very much the kind of sun around which people of culture revolve. And I suppose the classic example of that would be Shakespeare, loads of whose plays are set in Italy.
Well, I really wanted to ask about Shakespeare, because there is a theory, isn't there? An outlandish theory, it seems to me, that Shakespeare, it's one of these many conspiracy theories that the Shakespearean plays were not written by a man called William Shakespeare, but there's one theory that they were written by an Italian or a man of Italian extraction called John Florio. Are you aware of this?
I wasn't. Tell me more.
I was hoping you were aware of it. That's basically all I know.
Well, I know that there's a quite widely held theory that Shakespeare has these missing years.
Yes.
And nobody quite knows where he went. And the familiarity that he shows with Italy.
This is the Florio thing, that he knows, Shakespeare knows too much about Italy.
Thomas Cromwell, who launches the whole Reformation in England, he had been in Italy.
He had been in Italy.
So that's kind of quite a tried and tested path. And the idea and the theory is that maybe Shakespeare went there as a mercenary or a teacher or whatever.
But Shakespeare's geography is dodgy, isn't it? Because it's in the Winter's Tale where somebody gets a ship to Vienna or something like that.
From Bohemia. But I don't think anyone's suggesting he went to Bohemia. But you think of all the plays that are set in Venice and Rome, and of course Verona.
Romeo and Juliet. I suppose now, so what does that mean to those people who are seeing it, do you think, at the sort of turn of the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, when they're seeing this play set in Italy? Does that denote, that presumably doesn't denote, even though Italy is the home of the Pope, and Rome is the sort of headquarters of the Antichrist in people's minds, presumably that they have no problem with seeing plays set in Italy with a sympathetic Italian character. And that must still denote to them high culture, sophistication, lovely weather, citrus fruits.
If you think about it, there's a very sympathetic portrait of the friar who weds Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
He's not a kind of particular object of abuse in the play.
Yeah, he's not a Jesuit sort of conspirator.
Yeah, maybe that reflects sympathy for Catholicism. Lots of people in Shakespeare's part, lots of people have argued that. It's so difficult to know because Shakespeare's character is so opaque.
Yes.
But if you compare that with other playwrights who are doing portrayals of Italy at the same time, they're much more propagandistic. So you have all these Jacobean tragedies where you only have to have a cardinal and he's, fancying his sister and poisoning people and that kind of thing, poisoning Bibles and kissing skulls and things like that. And in those plays, Italy is portrayed as an absolute kind of sump of popery, depravity, murder, rape, incest, every sin possibly going is there, is taking part. And I think that does kind of mark a sea change in England's relationship to Italy, which is perhaps summed up by Milton, kind of devout Protestant, Puritan, going to Italy. And Milton is hugely, profoundly influenced by Italian culture. You know, he speaks Italian fluently. He's absolutely versed in the works of the great Italian poet.
So Mr. Red Dante and
yes, absolutely. All that stuff. But he goes to Italy on a kind of cultural pilgrimage. Obviously, not a pilgrimage of the kind that his English forebears had, because he's Puritan. But he one person he does go to see supposedly is Galileo, and he references it in Paradise Lost, his great poem, and he says Galileo is a great man. He has opened up untold worlds, unglimpsed worlds. And it's Milton really who articulates what will become the great myth that Galileo has been silenced and tortured by the Inquisition, by all the evil apparatus of the Roman Church.
Hold on, is that a myth?
It's a myth to the degree that Galileo is not tortured. He is not imprisoned.
Right. He was put under enormous pressure, though, wasn't he?
He's put under pressure. But I think we should do an episode on Galileo, because the whole Tom story Holland is so fascinating.
Describing this pressure in a very blasé way, I have to say.
What I would say is that Milton bigs up the repressive character of the Roman Church in a way that will have an enduring influence on the way that Protestants see the Catholic Church's relationship to astronomy, to the sciences.
That's how I view the Catholic Church. And that then
in the long run bleeds into the way that, say, atheists or secularists like to cast it. It's basically Philip Pullman. It's a Protestant myth.
Philip Pullman is a great... I mean, so Philip Pullman is the heir of Milton in this regard, isn't he? Well, obviously completely. Paradise Lost plays an enormous part in Philip Pullman's... And so Philip Pullman, I imagine, is not a... I mean, I don't know if he's a listener to this podcast. Let's assume not. He's not a great Italianophile in that sense. He would probably sign up to the sort of black legend. I mean, black legend is Spain, isn't it? But it's kind of equivalent.
The black legend that casts the Roman Church as a kind of sump of repressiveness and ignorance and bigotry and intolerance is, I mean, you know, there are elements of truth in it, but it gets massively amplified by English Protestants. And it has then, because you know, England and America have culturally been Protestant, it's kind of bled into post-Christian attitudes, you know, of hostility towards Christianity, which is often a kind of anti-Catholicism, really.
Yeah. Now, the producer is telling us we have to go for a break.
But I think that's the perfect moment, Dominic, because I think this has been very much a game of two halves. And the first half... Italy's dominated, but I think there's hope for England to come back in the second half.
Okay, jolly good. I was just about to say, and I'll just put it in because it fits here, just before we go for the break. So Italy are winning, but this is just a sort of footnote to that. We had a listener called Mikey who said, are you going to mention Mary of Modena in your podcast? If you don't, I won't tell you exactly what he said, but he would say he would soil himself in a warming pan. We have to mention her, and I think this is the moment. So Mary of Modena was the wife of James II, wasn't she? And she gave birth unexpectedly to a healthy baby boy just before Glorious Revolution. Well, this is the question. Or was a baby smuggled in a warming pan? Hence Mikey's threat. Well, when James II was kicked out, where did he go? And where did the Jacobites end up? I mean, the headquarters of Jacobitism was Rome, actually. And that sort of cemented, I think, Rome's reputation as the sort of anti-England par excellence, don't you think? So the old pretender, the young pretender, and then the last Jacobite, who I think was Henry the Ninth, as they called him, who was cardinal. And there's a monument to them still in Rome, a monument that presumably all sort of Protestant Englishmen, when they go on their trudging round St. Peter's, they regard with horror, because I think it's somewhere in St. Peter's. So that's just, to me, is the sort of tipping point, because that's the point at which Rome is associated with losers, the Jacobites. And obviously at that point, the engines of kind of English and then British capitalism begin to roar, and there's a sense of Britain kind of overtaking Italy. And hopefully we will make a second half comeback based on all that. So we'll see you after the break.
Hello. Hello, welcome back to the second half of England against Italy. As I said in the first half, I think this is going to be very much a game of two halves. First half, it was all Italy, all over the English. But I think now there's every chance that England can do a comeback. Dominic, I'm afraid I completely hogged that first half.
No, it's quite right. I think everybody enjoyed it. Well, I think, anyway.
But the second half, you've got lots of good stuff, and it all seems to be food-based.
Well, there's a lot about pasta and biscuits. Yeah. I think that's what people have come to this podcast for, to be honest. I don't think they've come about that. They don't give a damn about the Pope. They just want the bloody biscuits. Right, so let's start. I think we should start with the Grand Tour, because the Grand Tour, as a lot of people know, is a sort of 18th century phenomenon, late 17th, early 18th century phenomenon of people going, rich young aristocrats and whatnot would kind of go on this great expedition, almost like a colossal gap year. They'd go to France, then they'd sometimes go to Switzerland, and they'd always end up in Italy. I mean, Italy was always the place. And I guess this really reinforces what you were saying in the first half about the importance of Rome and the legacy of the Roman Empire, because that's what they're going to see, isn't it? They're going to see Roman ruins. I mean, Edward Gibbon, who, you know, I worship as this sort of titanic historian.
A wise, sceptical historian.
Exactly.
Like an owl.
I couldn't have put it better myself. So Gibbon goes in 1763 to 4, and there's this famous, you know, he has these famous lines. I can neither forget nor express the strong emotions which agitated my mind as I first approached and entered the eternal city and all this stuff. And then he says, you know, to be in the forum, the place where Romulus was, where Cicero spoke, where Caesar fell, and he's almost drunk with excitement. And it's then, or just a little bit later, that he's famously sitting among the ruins of the Capitol while the friars are singing Vespers in the Temple of Jupiter. And he has the idea of writing his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So you get this sort of sense of it, how in the 18th century, Rome still, some of the anti-Catholicism has faded, but you still have this sense of the sort of colossal sway. And that's kind of widespread, I think, across. So Dr. Johnson says a man who hasn't been to Italy is always conscious of an inferiority because he hasn't seen what a man ought to see.
That's true. But it's also ruins, isn't it?
It is ruins. So
the English lords and people like Gibbon and so on are going to see ruins.
Yeah.
And they're the ones with the cash. They're the ones with the big carriages. And basically they're there to gawp at, you know, the remnants of Italian greatness, and to bring back loot.
Well, they do, but they also go for more sordid reasons, more bodily reasons, Tom, because you know what Boswell wrote, a typical line from Boswell's diaries of his time in Italy?
I can imagine.
Yesterday morning with her, pulled up petticoat and showed whole knees. I was touched with her goodness, all other liberties exquisite.
Yeah, but
that's
Boswell,
exactly how I'd expect. He's Scottish though, isn't he? So maybe that doesn't really count.
But also, he was hardly remiss in
undertaking
similar research in London.
So all these guys go for the Grand Tour, right? And this is going to bring me to what I really want to talk about, which is macaroni. So all these people go for the Grand Tour. Now, macaroni was known in England because the first recipe for macaroni cheese comes from, I think, the very beginning of the 14th century in a book about curry.
That's so confusing.
That's a recipe for macaroni cheese, but clearly macaroni had been forgotten in the intervening period because all these people, they get a taste for macaroni when they're in Italy, and then they come back and they bring back not just their enthusiasm for macaroni, but their Italian style dress. I mean, there are some absolutely hilarious quotations. So they start. They say. I don't know whether it sort of starts as a saying among themselves. Sort of these sort of Trustafarian gap year veterans. They say, "Oh, you're looking very macaroni today, darling," or whatever. And then people start to mock them. So this is the Oxford Magazine in 1770. There is indeed a kind of animal, neither male nor female, a thing of the neuter gender, lately started up among us. It is called a macaroni. It talks without meaning, it smiles without pleasantry, it eats without appetite, it rides without exercise, it wenches without passion. So there's a sort of sense of effeminacy. And basically what's happening is these are guys who've come back with Italian fashions. So they're wearing multicoloured stockings, very sort of tight breeches. Their coats are considered too short.
Massive wigs.
And wigs that, I mean, the claim is that these wigs were half the size of a man.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You see,
and they had to kind of be carried by servants.
Yeah. And then they'd have a little hat on them on the top. And you could only get the hat off with a sword because it was so high up.
They didn't eat roast beef, which is always a bad sign.
I mean, they were seen as un-British. So the Universal magazine, 2 years after that, 1772, said, you may know a macaroni when you come near him by his essence and his scented waters. And you will discover him by seeing everything about him most extravagantly outré. He attends at auctions where he picks up the names of painters and vomits them forth at all occasions.
That's that kind of runs through, doesn't it? So Italian dancing masters, objects absolutely. Of absolute hilarity.
And I think,
and you think of Room with a View with Cecil.
So I think all of those things are picking up all this macaroni stuff. So I think Dickens and co are absolutely picking up this
actually,
up 100
Dominic,
years later.
Wouldn't you say the influence of all the opera in Italia 90?
Yeah.
In creating a kind of slightly effeminate
feminizing
class,
football. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And then the arrival of Italian players and indeed of Italian football on Channel 4 in the 1990s was part of a sort of gentrification of, a de-masculine proletarianization of football.
Because there's a kind of ambivalence there. Because on the one hand, there is a sense of Italy as, mafiosi, diving, unlike our brave British, our brave English strikers.
We would never do that.
So there is that. But then, of course, there is also the sense of this macaroni tradition.
Well, the other thing about the macaroni thing is there's obviously a whole lot of stuff about sexuality and gender kind of bound up with that about.
Go on.
So there's somebody wrote a journal of a macaroni. And it reads like that. I can't read it all. It is very funny. Rise at 11, survey my sweet, this is a diary, this is what they do in the day, survey my sweet face in the glass and pick my teeth for half an hour, breakfast at 12, saunter to the park and stare at the women for the reputation of having a taste for them. So he's only doing it for the reputation, not because he wants to stare at the women. And then he goes to the coffee house, goes to the theatre. 9 o'clock, take a woman of the town to the Shakespeare, treat her with a bottle of champagne and leave her as I found her. And that, and the sort of damning thing there is that he's leaving her as he found her. He's not sort of debauching her because the assumption, the implication is because he's gay and all of this stuff is just for show. So that's kind of, there is that always this stuff about Italian effeminacy, which runs through, I mean, I think it's probably gone now, but it's, no one would look at Giorgio Chiellini, the captain of Italy, and say he's an effeminate man. He's not. He looks like a kind of Roman centurion from Central Casting. But that obviously runs through from, I say, the 18th century to the mid 20th, to mods, when mods were sometimes dissed by rockers as effeminate.
And a bit Italianate.
Yeah, obviously Italianate, because they wore Italian fashions and they had their scooters and they went to coffee bars and things. Exactly.
So there's this kind of association with youth culture.
Yeah.
Fashion.
Yeah.
Gender bending.
Absolutely.
Cutting it. So cutting edge. And so the Yankee Doodle went to town.
Wow. Yes. This is fascinating.
So that's a joke about Americans being backward.
Being backward and trying to be macaronis and failing. So this is a really weird thing. And our American listeners will find this weird because they think of Yankee Doodle Dandy as a patriotic song as it's become. But it began as an insult that British redcoats would sing during the American War of Independence to mock the Americans. So the first, I think, is it the first verse? I don't know. Yankee Doodle went to town, a riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap and called it macaroni. It's basically right. Exactly that. You know, they're putting a feather in their cap because they think it's going to make them look like a dandy.
But
they want to have
because actually
the,
you need a massive wig.
Yeah, because they're just sort of hayseeds. Exactly
so,
that.
So you get that tradition going through with Byron being the famous example of a lord who goes to Italy, who writes about its Gibbon had done, about its ruins, about its beauty, about but also mourning the fact that it is it's basically prostrate and humiliated, that it's under the thumb of the church, it's under the thumb of the Austrians, it's fragmented, there's no prospect of it recovering its former greatness. But then I guess over the 19th century, gradually it does.
Yeah.
This is where the biscuits come in.
The key man here is Garibaldi. Now I'll come to, maybe we should start with the biscuit. Everybody, to me, a Garibaldi is a very, very fine biscuit. I know people often have these World Cups of biscuits on Twitter and so on.
World Cups are a ridiculous idea.
It's so tawdry and shallow, isn't it? Anyway, Garibaldi never does as well in these competitions as I think it should, because I think it's an absolute...
It's a bit boring.
No, I think the Garibaldi is a marvellous biscuit.
Anyway, listen, Dominic.
Do you know when the Garibaldi was invented, Tom?
1865.
Oh, God, you've clearly swatted up on it. It's 1861.
Was it?
It's 1861.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing it was named after Garibaldi.
It's such a shame the listeners can't see just how childishly pleased you are that you almost got it right. So, yes, Garibaldi, you know, most people will have some vague awareness that he's a guy in a red shirt and he is key in the unification of Italy. So he was quite famous in England before the unification of Italy, because he was famous for his role in, he'd tried to lead a revolution in 1848, and then he'd gone around kind of trying to raise funds. So he'd gone to America, for example. And actually, when he was going to America, I think 1854, he stopped in Newcastle. So Dan Jackson is a friend of the podcast who's always tweeting us things that he knows far more about than we do.
Well, almost but they always have a Newcastle link.
They always have a Newcastle link, and he will definitely know more about this than us. Garibaldi arrives in March 1854, and he gives speeches to all these working men for Italian unification, for liberty, and so on. And this is precisely the kind of cause that's very popular with kind of, you know, working men's groups and sort of liberal-minded people in the middle of the 19th century. You know, let's build Italy, throw off the shackles of it, these old empires, and so on. He's given a golden sword bought by public donation by the people of Newcastle, inscribed with the words, presented to General Garibaldi by the people of Tyneside, Friends of European Freedom, April 1854.
God, I can just imagine Dan purring as he wrote to you about that.
Exactly. So then 6 years later, Garibaldi has his most famous sort of moment in history when he leads what's called the Expedition of Emile, the Thousand, to land in Sicily. And he's going to attack the kingdom of the two Sicilies, which is run by the Bourbons.
Hence, more biscuits.
Also a biscuit, but later. Also a very good biscuit, I think, but not as good as a Garibaldi. Now, he has huge support in England for this, because, again, he's a liberal hero, sort of hero of liberty and stuff. So tens of thousands of pounds are donated to help his expedition. The Times war correspondent goes with him all the way, or every sort of step of the way. But crucially, the Royal Navy supports Garibaldi's landings in Sicily. So they send HMS Hannibal, ironically, of all the ships to send HMS Hannibal and two gunboats, Argus and Intrepid. And they basically make it possible for him to land. The Bourbon ships, which aren't as good as ours, can't sort of do anything to stop him. Garibaldi lands in Sicily. He captures Sicily. Then he goes over to Italy and he sort of marches up towards Naples and sets in train this great sort of series of, frankly, to me, incomprehensible and baffling.
But it does ultimately involve a march on Rome, right?
Yeah, they march on Rome eventually. So, exactly.
And the Pope is hostile to this.
Yeah, the papacy is against papal troops, fight against the Kingdom of Piedmont, which is the Garibaldi's big ally in the sort of.
And so, how is this playing with kind of anti-Catholic opinion back in England?
Well, I think it's all. I mean, incredibly well. I mean, the anti-Catholic people, but people generally absolutely love this. So, by 1864, when Garibaldi's had a lot of success and he comes back to London, he's met by, I think, 500,000 people in London on the streets, which is unbelievable when you think in the context.
He's a freedom fighter.
He's a freedom fighter.
Anti-Catholic.
Exactly.
He's everything that he stays at.
He stays at a place called Stafford House, and he's so popular that the servants make a fortune by bottling the soap suds from his wash basin.
God, it's like the Beatles.
And selling them to. It's exactly that. So, but overall, the great and the good want to see him as well, Lord Palmerston and people like that. There is a massive trade. Garibaldi is one of the most memorialized men of the 19th century in knickknacks, in merchandise. So there's dolls and there's plates and there's tankards and there's ceramics and there's postcards because there's photos of him. He plants a tree in Tennyson's garden.
So basically,
he's a celebrity. He's a
superstar. Basically, the establishment of Italy. It's down to us.
It's because of the Navy and because of down to us and Garibaldi. And there's a football link because he goes and gives a speech, I think, in Nottingham or Nottinghamshire, or there's some Nottinghamshire connection, which means that when people start playing as Nottingham Forest Football Club, they wear red tasseled hats called Garibaldi hats. And then later on, when they decide that hats are not suitable for football, they wear red shirts instead, in honour of Garibaldi. So there's a football link. There are still tons of roads all across Britain called Garibaldi Street or Garibaldi Road. There are at least 8 pubs, Garibaldi pubs, and the biscuit. So Garibaldi leaves this incredible legacy, and the Bourbons can't really compete. They also have a biscuit, But their biscuit isn't launched until the 19... Well, the biscuit is launched early, but they don't add their name to it until the 1930s, by which time it is far too late because Italy is under different management, as we all know, in the 1930s.
I think it's an index of my essentially reactionary character that I do actually prefer Bourbons.
Yeah, well, that says it all, doesn't it? As a Bourbon, you have learned nothing and forgotten nothing, or whatever it is. I can't remember what it is.
But you as the kind of instinctive revolutionary...
So,
your red-blooded Marxism.
Exactly.
But you mentioned football.
Yeah.
Of course, the famous detail is that AC Milan, does it not begin as a cricket club?
I think it does. It does. Exactly. Well, that's why it's called Milan rather than Milano.
Yes. So it's founded by
English.
It's very much, rather like Augustine coming to Canterbury and spreading Christianity.
Yeah.
English people go to Milan, set up a cricket club, set up a football club. Disappointingly, the Italians aren't as keen on cricket as they are on football.
But also, I believe Juventus, which is by far the most popular Italian team, supported all across Italy, not just in Turin. Juventus got their black and white colours from Notts County. So the Nottingham, this is basically a Nottinghamshire, Italy relations podcast rather than
So it really is the case that when Italy play at Wembley, they will be coming home.
They will be coming home. Very good. But Tom, so at this point, Italy is thought of very well in British circles, high and low. But then in the 20th century, I think it's fair to say that by and large, people had very low opinion of the Italians politically. So in the First World War, Italy lines up, as it were, on the other side of the draw at the beginning. So they're supposed to be in an alliance with Germany and with Austria. And basically, about a year into the war, they completely break that alliance, stab their allies in the back and decide they're going to attack Austria. And they do that in the most... I mean, it's very hard to... I don't want to sound like I'm biased, but it's very hard to defend their behaviour here because they do it in a very weaselly way. They basically say to Britain and France, what will you give us to join you? We want land, we want Austrian territory. And all the British sort of politicians, they want Italy on side, but... Asquith, for example, he describes it as that most voracious, slippery, and perfidious power. It's important to bring Italy in at once, greedy and slippery as she is, says. Churchill described Italy as the harlot of Europe. Lloyd George, they are the most contemptible nation. And Jackie Fisher, who was the first Sea Lord, he said, the Italians are mere organ grinders. They will be no use whatsoever.
Could I join in with some abuse of Italy?
Do, yeah.
Okay, so First World War, obviously, they were on our side.
Yeah.
Second World War,
incredibly bloody.
Second World War, they weren't. They were against us.
They
were
indeed.
And led by Mussolini, of course.
Also entered late, as they had in the First World War.
Yep. I've been sent this by Wavell.
Yeah. Well, he didn't send it himself, did he?
He said this himself, but
he didn't send it to you. You said,
This was sent by my friend Daisy Christodoulou, who will be coming on and talking about exams, history of exams, to coincide with...
That sounds more like a threat.
A-level and GCSE results. So Wavell...
Yeah.
This is fabulous. We can name the nations who started the fire. Germany and Japan. Stupid, ill-bred children who have never been properly brought up or learnt good international manners. Their silly little girlfriend, Italy, joined them in hopes of some cheap fun and now finds herself being taken for a ride with two really bad boys. And that is not going to be cheap for her or much fun. I mean, that's the kind of commentary that I think we want from...
But for the commentators on Sunday night. But that was so common. I mean, I suppose because of the weight of the sort of post-Macaroni stuff, it was almost impossible for the British in World War II to think of the Italians in any other way. So there's a description of one British officer who describes the Italians heading from Libya into Egypt. He says they looked as if they're on their way to a birthday party.
And also all the jokes about Italian tanks only having a reverse.
Well, this is the thing. So when we captured Tobruk and so on in 1941... there's some wonderful descriptions from the Australian journalist Alan Moorhead, who wrote a brilliant book about the war in the desert. And he says, basically, when I got to the Italian camp, I found it full of linen bedsheets, lace-trimmed uniforms, tasseled belts, peacock hats. And then later on, there's a big box or something, and they look in it and they say, jars of bottled cherries, tins of ham, anchovies and bread. Basically, the Italians are packed for a picnic.
Well, you remember the episode we did on games, on war games. And there's some massive war game about the war in Italy.
That's right.
Where every round you have to have enough fuel to boil up the water for the Italian army's pasta. Yeah. So that kind of mockery of Italian war martial efforts carries on right into the present day. But it is fair to say, is it not, Dominic?
Yes.
That the invasion of Italy in the Second World War is incredibly brutal, incredibly bloody.
Yes.
And actually, the British come to have a huge admiration and respect for the partisans.
I think they do, yes.
And they're slightly frightened of them, to be honest.
I also think it's really fascinating, Tom, how after the war, there is still a lot of bad blood about towards the Germans and the Japanese. And there's the classic thing of people who won't buy a German or a Japanese car. But nobody ever says that about Vespa scooters or about Fiats or about Italian coffee.
I think the Italians are felt to have contributed to their own liberation.
I think it's partly that, but I also think it's partly that Wavell quote that you said earlier on, that the Italians have been led astray, that they there's this sort of slightly patronising attitude. I mean, I will say one thing. So in case people are listening to it and thinking, oh, this is very sort of jingoistic and they're laughing at Italians, there is another element to the Italian story in the war, which is actually very sobering, which is what happens to the Italians in Britain. So there's a lot of Italians, particularly in Scotland, and they are pretty atrociously treated. So people go and smash the windows of their shops. I mean, some of them are Italians who'd fought for us in the First World War in our army.
Yeah.
And their shops are all smashed. They're looted. One shop owner in, I think, Edinburgh is shot dead. And the crowds kind of riot and they beat people up and stuff. Another biscuit, McVitie's, the biscuit factory, they sacked all their Italian staff out of hand. And Churchill was basically, he's asked, what should we do about the Italians? And he famously says, collar the lot. So every Italian in Britain is rounded up. Hundreds of them are put into camps, well, thousands of them. Hundreds are put on a ship called the Arandora Star. There were 1,200 people, mostly Italians, but Germans as well. Some of them refugees. They're sent off to camps in Canada, but they're torpedoed by a German U-boat along the way. And about 800 people are killed. So these are Italian waiters, people who, I mean, literally organ grinders, or people who work in ice cream shops and so on, all the classic things that Italians did before the war. 800 of them die. The rest are just put on another ship and then sent to Australia. When they get to Australia, they're kind of beaten up and they're, all their possessions are stolen from them. So it's a really sad and sort of shameful chapter.
Yeah.
So it's not all kind of, you know, fun and games, this. I mean, there are sort of sad and dark chapters to the story as well.
But then post-war, I mean, relations have been
pretty good, I think. Been jolly good.
I mean, the Italians surpass us, don't they? There's Il Sapasso.
Yes. They have this tremendous economic growth. I mean, this economic miracle in the 1950s.
So we've spent, you know, three centuries sneering at them for being economically backward, and then they zoom ahead of us.
But what's really remarkable, actually, is the legacy. So you talked right at the beginning about Rome and Rome being the centre and Rome being more sophisticated and more civilised. So in the periods that I've written about, let's say the 1950s and 1960s, people absolutely had that view of Italian culture. Italian films, Fellini and Antonioni and so on, they were more highbrow. Italian fashion was the thing, you know, Italian shoes, Italian trousers. As we said, mods, you know, went out of their way to look
like
Italians.
But also, Dominic, I mean, also the enduring appeal of the stuff that enthused, you know, Chaucer and perhaps Shakespeare.
Italian poetry, you know,
Well, Tuscany is a kind of shorthand, isn't it, for
upper
middle class elite tastes.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a Guardian columnist, by law, you have to go on holiday to Tuscany.
That's the joke,
summer,
isn't it? I mean, that is the kind of, that is absolutely still the shorthand. So
yes,
just as in the 14th century, in the 21st century, Tuscany, you know, it conjures up everything.
That, how much of that is kind of aspirational? Is to do with the legacy of Rome, Tom?
I don't think that has much to do with the legacy of Rome.
Don't you?
I think it's to do with the beauty of the landscape, with the beauty of the art. I think it's much more a Renaissance thing.
I think if you say to a child, for example, Rome. Lots of people love going to Rome.
Yeah, but it's flop. No, but you know, Tuscany, as in short.
Well, Tuscany
people
specifically,
from Hampstead,
okay. Tuscany specifically
it's
is
Florence
sort of,
and
the Guardian reader's fantasy. I agree, that's kind of a Renaissance thing. But people go to Pompeii, don't they? And the first time I went to Naples or indeed to Rome, there was this real sense of electric excitement. You know, these are real. These are the real places.
Of course, absolutely. I mean, yes, of course. The Rome is a huge part of the appeal if you're a tourist. But I think the lifestyle thing.
Yeah,
I think
it's more Renaissance.
The Italian, you know, the Dolce Vita. I know it's set in Rome, yeah. So that torpedoes my argument. But I think that the sense of Italian fashion of Italian style is.
I think you're absolutely kind of rooted in the Renaissance. To plug your own book, Rubicon, which has the most fantastic descriptions of Roman villas,
yes, but they've gone,
and the luxury on the Bay of Naples.
But they've gone.
Well,
Naples. I mean, Naples is a wonderful city. It's my favourite city in Italy.
Yeah,
but it's not a place you'd go for
burning piles of rubbish.
The high end.
That's what I go for. People setting rubbish on fire because the mafia have refused to collect it.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's what makes Naples such a thrilling place to visit. It's not what it was in the days of the late Republic.
When I went to Naples, the coffee machine and B&B exploded in a very disturbing way. That's the main.
Well, Naples also, of course, has a shrine to Maradona.
It does. I've seen that shrine to Maradona.
Yes,
and of course, the home of the pizza
with the holy hair.
Does he have holy hair?
There's a single hair, I think, from Maradona's head. Well, full of cocaine.
When on a football related, when Argentina played Italy in Naples in the 1990 World Cup, Maradona tried to incite the people of Naples against the Italian national team because he said, "You're Neapolitans, you're not Italians." And that actually, we haven't really talked about that at all, about whether Italy is artificial. So yeah. There was a great book a few years ago by David Gilmour, and he basically said Italy is a fake country. It shouldn't really exist as one country. I mean, the trouble is you could say that about so many.
But I'm sure Italians would say the same about Britain.
Well, exactly, so. They would. Exactly, they would. I mean,
they're playing England and not Britain.
Yes. So we're just rambling now, and I think it's time for a prediction.
I think that Italy will win based on my viewing of the two semifinals. I think 2-1.
2-1, yes. I think Italy will win. I think they will win. I think they'll win 1-0. I think England will huff and puff, and the Italians are too wily in defence.
What I will also say about the Italian team is this sweep of history we've been doing from Roman times up to the present day is that they all look like figures from Italian history.
Do you know, I was thinking, if he doesn't say that, I will say it.
Because so we have said that about the England team, but I think that's even truer.
Unbelievably gratifying, I find, because I'm a man who loves and trades in national stereotypes. So I find it incredibly gratifying when a national team look as they should, when they just look like a casting agency has supplied some Italians. And that's exactly every man of them. They just look, they couldn't be anybody else. They couldn't be France. They couldn't be Germany.
I find all my... you know, my Jacobean Protestantism kicking in.
Yeah.
And I kind of imagine them going off to poison nunneries and things. They have that look.
They even did a thing. So I don't know if you saw, but before their penalty shootout with Spain, the Italian captain, Chiellini.
I did.
And he was kind of doing this fake punching and embracing of the Spanish captain. And the Spanish captain, Jordi Alba, just looked so
much smaller.
Yeah, he was small and he just looked utterly distraught and kind of intimidated. I mean, that's the wrong word, but he was just put out that this sort of Italian leaning over him, putting his arms around him, all of this stuff. I mean, they're crafty, aren't they? They've had thousands of years.
Yes. And I suspect that they will notch up another victory. But we will see. Anyway, I've very much enjoyed the Euros this time round. Particularly for the opportunity it's provided to Dominic to talk to you about England's relations with the various countries that we have played. So I'm very sad to see it end, but I'm also absolutely thrilled that England have made it this far, not just for patriotic reasons, but because we've been given the chance to talk about Italy as well as Denmark, Ukraine and Germany. So thank you to the England team. Thank you to listening to us. And hopefully we'll be back maybe for the World Cup. Who knows?
All right. Splendid. See you all next time. Good luck, England. It's coming home. Goodbye.